Good morning. See, I did not say the rest of it. The best introduction to this lecture is the question that gave rise to it, which was written to me by a very knowledgeable objectivist. And in essence, he wrote me, this is his words just condensed, quote, "Unfortunately for an objectivist, artworks that combine aesthetic greatness and philosophical truth are rare. Can artworks that are based on false or mixed premises satisfy a rational man's need for art? If so, how? More specifically, why should one enter the dark world of Dostoevsky or the deterministic world of Tolstoy? What benefit can there be from experiencing such art when the philosophy they concretize blatantly contradicts one's own?" Unquote. That's an excellent question, and I'm going to confine my answer today to literature, even though what I say will apply in principle to all art. Now, the question asks for the value of such art, great art with philosophically false themes, to a rational man. And I'm going to answer using value in the strictly objectivist sense, that which sustains and enhances one's life, that which has practical efficacy in regard to one's survival. So I'm going to maintain that Dostoevsky and Tolstoy and the like do have such value, even given their false and their anti-objectivist themes. And I'm going to say that they have value precisely qua art, not because of any extra artistic feature. I'm not going to try and justify them on the grounds of the knowledge you can gain from them, or the history or psychology they will teach you, or the witty social criticism with which they're full. I'm not even going to talk about the value to you of the aesthetic technique of these artists, because I'm addressing you today not as art specialists, but as human beings. Our concern is not how, not the brilliance by which these authors achieve their goals, but simply what they do as great artists, what they do that can have survival value to you as an objectivist. Now, what motivation do I expect you to have to care about this? I think this is a very powerful motivation, judging by what I've witnessed of the objectivist movement. Not all of you this would apply to, but many people in this room, I'm sure, because many objectivists read and reread Ayn Rand to the point where she is, in effect, memorized. And then they get what they can from a handful of romantics, more or less easily accessible, and at that point they give up literature, and on the same premise, most serious art, and restrict themselves thereafter only to popular fiction or movies that are on a par with watching TV, afternoon talk shows, or playing computer games. In other words, the people I'm talking about content themselves with time-killing, basically meaningless amusement. Now, far be it for me to put that down. That's great as sheer rest or relaxation, but that is not what you get from soul-nourishing, life-enhancing, great art. And I say that these objectivists are spiritually starved, whether they know it or not, because art is a crucial need of man. And yet, if they do try to plunge into what's called great art, they are invariably either bored out of their skulls or outraged. Now, I want to try to tell you today what to look for in these, in certain category of great but false art, so your boredom and outrage would be translated into excitement and emotional fuel. Now, if that isn't motivation, I don't know what is. Now, I stress that the theme of an artwork is not our concern today. We're talking about works despite their themes. So, I'm not going to talk about theme, but I just want to remind you in advance of the absolute, utter falsehood of most of the themes and ideas of the authors we'll be talking about, and especially the Russians that I'm going to use today, Dostoevsky and Tolstoy. Dostoevsky is definitely better in this regard than Tolstoy. He's a strong believer in free will. He's a moralist. He's an individualist. He denounces socialism, none of which applies to Tolstoy. Despite this, however, Dostoevsky would hate, he was subject to epilepsy, and he would have a fit if he read Atlas Shrugged. He and Tolstoy agree, and I'm just giving you a sample, on such ideas as the evil of a person asserting his own will, the necessity of man's obedience, whether to God or society, the nobility of sacrifice and or suffering, and above all, they agree in their many repeated explicit assaults on reason, logic, science, the intellect, all of which they regard in effect as seductions by the evil West, if not by the devil himself. Remember that, because my point is that none of it alters the thesis of the survival value of their art. Or to put it paradoxically, my thesis is the life-sustaining value of certain art works, even if they're built on anti-life themes. But that is a paradox. How do I justify such an outrageous claim? Well, I'm a recent convert, as many of you know, to induction. But I'm going to start with some instances of one attribute of literature, characterization, and then generalize. This is a fake induction, because I'm going to generalize after one instance, because that's all I have time to do. But at least it'll give you a clue. I want to jump in with a little vignette from Anna Karenina. How many of you have not read Anna Karenina? That's what I thought. All right. This is self-contained. The story is straightforward, although it has several logical subplots. Anna is presented as an honest, passionate woman, unhappily married to a semi-swine. She falls totally in love with a dashing army officer, Count Vronsky. She does not want to love him. She wants to remain faithful to her husband. This is a tragedy to her that she's fallen in love this way. And here's the first scene I want you to notice apropos of developing the thesis. She's coming home to St. Petersburg from a visit to Moscow. And she deliberately, methodically, as a virtuous woman, pushes thoughts of Vronsky out of her mind and makes an effort of benevolence toward the husband she's going to meet. She orients herself toward resuming her normal life. And this is Tolstoy's first introduction of the husband. Quote, and right at that point, at Petersburg, as soon as the train stopped and she got out, the first person who attracted her attention was her husband. Oh my God, why do his ears look like that, she thought. Looking at his frigid and distinguished figure, and especially the ears that struck her at the moment as propping up the brim of his round hat. And then to jump ahead a couple paragraphs, and he speaks. Yes, as you see, your tender spouse, as devoted as the first year after marriage, burning with impatience to see you, he said in his deliberate, high-pitched voice, and in that tone which he almost always took with her, a tone of jeering at anyone who should say in earnest what he said. Unquote. Now, this is a little gem in which a totally unknown character, we've never met him, is revealed objectively, physically, and psychologically at a glance in a few strokes. Now, let's jump about 40 pages. Same character. Anna and Vronsky and her husband, along with many others, are at a party, and Anna and Vronsky are sitting together talking. Quote, the husband, Karenin, had seen nothing striking or improper in the fact that his wife was sitting with Vronsky at a separate table in eager conversation with him about something. But the husband noticed that to the rest of the party, this appeared to be something striking and improper. And for that reason, it seemed to him, too, to be improper. He made up his mind that he must speak of it to his wife, unquote. There's another quick glance at Karenin, and a total second-hander is revealed. Now, this is a tiny example, and of course, I admit most novelists are much better at characterizing bad characters than good, but nevertheless, just from this little taste, you can see in miniature what great art does in regard to characterization. And what it does is focus on and capture the essence of a person through every detail that you are presented. Now, to appreciate the value of this, I want you to contrast with this the way you and I, most of the time, look at people and pretty much have to in daily life. How often we are puzzled by others, the incredible, unanalyzable package deals of good, bad, and neuter that we cannot decipher, the accidental influences on them which we find difficult or impossible to disentangle from their basic character, the routine behavior which we often don't focus on or even fully perceive precisely because it is routine. In many daily cases, any essentialized perception of others, and I mean here not others in a book, but the others you actually deal with, is so elusive and difficult as often to seem either impossible or simply too time-consuming to be worth the bother. And the result of this as a habitual way of dealing with people is often an implicit attitude that we can fall into by default unknowingly. The attitude of just accepting people as they are without even trying to make much sense of them. And the implicit result of that can very easily become a feeling of being drained, a sense of futility, an unanswered question looming over your life. What are people? What moves them? How can I understand or deal with them? What is life all about? Now, this is where the artistic characterizer has an invaluable perspective to offer. I want to quote something from Ayn Rand from the Romantic Manifesto. Quote, out of the countless number of concretes, of single, disorganized, and seemingly contradictory attributes, actions, and entities, an artist isolates the things which he regards as metaphysically essential and integrates them into a single new concrete that represents an embodied abstraction, unquote. Or the way I put the point in Opar, an artist selects out of the bewildering chaos of human experience, the bewildering chaos of life as you live it, those aspects he regards as indicative. In this case, of course, indicative of the essence of a given human type. And in regard to characterization, this very selectivity counteracts the daily message that is hammered into us of accident, routine, contradictions, and unintelligibility. It gives us a fresh, essentialized perspective on people and therefore on man. By giving us characters stylized in essential terms, it's, you could think of it as like a vaccination or a booster shot, telling you on the deepest level, men's attributes are meaningful. Men do have identities. They can be understood. Life is not a tale told by an idiot full of sound and fury signifying nothing. Now, I realize that many of you are just itching at this point to object and say, why do I have to wade through all this rotten art? Because I know all that from objectivist theory. I know that life is purposeful and men are intelligible, etc. So who needs art for it? And my answer is, it is not enough to know it in theory. You must know it on the perceptual level. You must perceive the concretes around you in such terms. You must be able to turn your philosophic abstract knowledge that men operate in terms of essentials into a framework governing your actual daily perception of people. And this is one thing that great art does in regard now to characterization. It reminds you concretely, perceptually, by its form of focus, that all the accidental elements, the routine and the chaos of life is only on the surface. And you see, it makes no difference here. This is the very, very crucial point. It makes no difference here whether the character in question is good or evil, or even whether the value standard of the author is true or false. It makes no difference to this function. If the characterization itself is great, in other words, in terms of essentials, that is a vital reorientation for you as an objectivist, because it gives you men seen through a purposeful lens. Men who, whether they're good, evil, or mixed, above all, are clear, in focus, intelligible, and therefore meaningful. Now that's the start on my thesis. I don't mean to suggest, of course, that great characterization is as simple as the few vignettes that I quoted. And if you'd read Tolstoy, you'd know that his presentation of Anna's husband is much more complex than the few paragraphs I mentioned. Let me take a brief look, therefore, while we're on characterization, at the hero or villain or protagonist of Crime and Punishment, Raskolnikov, from the same perspective. Now, Dostoevsky generally offers much deeper characterizations than Tolstoy. Not more purposeful, but deeper, because he is both a profound psychologist and a passionate moralist. So his characters are like the onion. You take off one skin and then another skin and then another skin until finally you get down to the very inside layer. That's what he specialized in. In fact, he brought psychological penetration to characterization. And therefore, his characterization often takes the form of a drawn-out suspense story. What really motivates this man? You don't know it right away, the way in which you do most often in Tolstoy, and it becomes fascinating to see the logic by which you find out, but at the end, it's still as crystal clear as if it were presented in a vignette. Now, for instance, how many have not read Crime and Punishment? Well, I guess you've seen the movie, is that the idea? The question of Crime and Punishment is, why does Raskolnikov, who also, reading Russian novels, you have to remember they all have multiple names and then nicknames that don't have any relation to the real name. So, you know, you pick one name and then just make a chart of equivalents. But why does Raskolnikov, this is really the question as far as characterization goes, presented as a handsome, moody, kindly, extremely honest whim worshiper? It's already quite a combo. Why does he, at the outset of the novel, take an axe and chop two old women to death with it? That's a crime. And that's the characterization question that Dostoevsky asks in Crime and Punishment, and his answer is revealed slowly across hundreds of pages. Raskolnikov himself doesn't really know why he did it at first. He has a swarm of possible motives, but it's not too clear to him, and he keeps breaking down in health and lying down and trying to evade the whole thing, and then it nags at him and he wakes up and tries to find out more. Gradually he finds out, and at different points he offers all kinds of different possible explanations, each of which seems to hold and then is conflicts with another. For instance, at one point the novel cites Jeremy Bentham in The Greatest Good of the Greatest Number and has Raskolnikov agree with the idea, I'm motivated by the welfare of mankind, and if only I knock out this pawnbroker who doesn't do any good to anybody, and I can distribute her money and make everybody happy. So he's a Benthamite. Somebody once said that Crime and Punishment is a novel in which Jeremy Bentham is provided with an axe. So Since utilitarianism, Bentham's theory was something Dostoevsky hated because it didn't come from God. Then at another point, it's not the greatest happiness or the greatest number, it's Hegel that Raskolnikov is appealing to. Hegel had this theory you probably know of, world historical men, the three most famous of which was Alexander the Great, Julius Caesar, and Napoleon. And I'm sure if he had lived into the 20th century, he would have added Adolf Hitler. And these world historical men represented God on earth and were the vehicles for moving history to the next stage of its development. And they were not subject to any laws, any human definitions of good or evil, crime, and so on. They transcended all of our petty concerns because they were the agents of God moving history. And Raskolnikov certainly flirts with that and wrote an article in favor of it and found that intriguing. And he may, part of the time the suggestion is, maybe I'm a world historical man. And then part of the time it's presented as all this stuff is theory. All he really wants is enough money to look after his sister and his mother and to see that he gets through school. So it's like conventional, my family and my career. Each of these seem to be plausible and others beside, but none of them integrate all of the evidence. And Dostoevsky is brilliant, by the way, at showing you how they don't. For instance, all these, some of these explanations hinge on what he's going to do with the money. And the absolutely fascinating thing here is that Raskolnikov has absolutely no interest in the money from the moment he commits the crime. He doesn't count it. He doesn't look at it. He buries it and forgets it totally. So all these are obviously rationalizations that have nothing to do with all the, quote, good that he could accomplish. Anyway, jumping ahead later in the novel, there's a very dramatic, suspenseful scene. He decides to confess to Sonia, who's an 18-year-old Christian prostitute with a heart of gold. She's 110% Christian, super humble, and she looks at him wide-eyed as he works out his actual motivation in the process of his confession. And it's absolutely stunning scene in which he makes an impassioned statement that this is his motivation, and then he says, that's ridiculous, that's nonsense, forget it, and refutes it completely. All stuff that you've seen, it's like the psychological summing up, and then this is where we finally get to the nugget. He's going back to his earlier days before the crime, and he says to her, oh, how I hated that garret where he lived, a little cramped, tiny, poverty-stricken garret, and yet I wouldn't go out of it. I wouldn't on purpose. I didn't go out for days together, and I wouldn't work. I wouldn't even eat. I just lay there doing nothing. And if somebody brought me anything, I ate it, and if they didn't, I went all day without. I wouldn't ask on purpose from sulkiness, which is, would be an objectivist way of saying from whim worship. I didn't feel like it. I was filled with resentment at the world and the unfairness of life, and I was just going to sit there and suffer and to hell with it. And then he goes on, for the first time in my life, an idea took shape in my mind which no one had ever thought of before me. No one. I saw clear as daylight how strange it is that not a single person living in this mad world has had the daring to go straight for it all and send it flying to the devil. I wanted to have the daring. And I killed her. I only wanted to have the daring, Sonia. That was the whole cause of it. It wasn't to help my mother that I did the murder. That's nonsense. I did the murder for myself alone. And whether I became a benefit to others or spent my life sucking the life out of men, I couldn't have cared at that moment. I wanted to find out then and quickly whether I was a louse like everybody else or a man. Whether I can step over barriers or not, unquote. In other words, he killed in order to be able to think highly of himself, in order to be able to say, I am an exceptional person. I've taken an exceptional action. I'm not like everybody else, all these weak, louse-like conformists around me. So if you put it in objectivist terms, he killed in order to achieve self-esteem. And to him, the only form of self-assertion is stepping over the barrier. In other words, defying society. In other words, destruction and nihilism. And that's what emerges ultimately as the deepest explanation that integrates everything else that he's done. And in the very act of uttering this, Raskolnikov recognizes what it means about him. He's filled with self-disgust, and he concludes that he is loathsome, that he always knew he was loathsome. He's a louse, in his words, like everybody else. Now, this is a fantastic characterization because you see it unfolding before you, and it's crystal clear at the end. Now, Dostoevsky draws from all this the moral, that theories, ideas, philosophers like Bentham, Hegel, and so on, have helped to seduce Raskolnikov's better nature, his kindness and so on, and overwhelmed him, and that he would have been okay if only he hadn't been exposed to thought, intellect, and pride. But of course, that is not the point we're talking about here today. My point today is that all of this complexity, every aspect of Raskolnikov's characterization is purposeful. Every trait, every self-doubt, every spasm of anger, every guilty urge to confess, it's completely stylized to draw out the essence of a person. And the book ends up as being the perfect X-ray vision of a soul. Now I want to generalize beyond characterization. Because my point here is not that great art is not N-O-T. That great art teaches you motivation or psychology. But rather, it teaches you how to look at daily events through X-ray glasses, which you can keep on after you close the book. Art gives you the inner feel of what it is like to essentialize, which you can continue to do when you look up. So the critical value that it offers is not the artist's idea of what is essential, which may be completely wrong. It's not the conclusions he draws from his particular focus, which might be completely wrong. It's the fact of the essentializing focus as such. Now here you have to appreciate that the basic function of art is not, the basic function is not to objectify and contemplate moral values. That is the model-building function of art. And it's applicable only to romantic art, you know, the kind that presents what might be and what ought to be. The basic function of art, however, is to recreate reality according to the artist's metaphysical value judgments. In other words, the basic function is metaphysical, not ethical. And that means that you are offered something invaluable in the very act of contemplating or reading it. You're offered something psycho-epistemological as a direct consequence of the fact that its specialization is metaphysical stylization. What you are offered is practice in perceiving the universe via a deliberate policy of inclusion and exclusion. Practice in perceiving the universe with the unimportant dropped out and only the important retained. Practice in perceiving the universe according to what counts, even if in your actual life what counts is less than 1% of what actually inundates you. The sheer fact of immersing yourself in great art can enable you to learn this technique of perception even when the value standard of the artist involved is wrong. And this is what Ayn Rand called the stylizing power of art, its power to stylize your consciousness. And here let me read you a paragraph from Opar, which is the gist of my answer to the question today. Quote, art is concerned to teach. What it teaches, however, is not a theory, but a technique of directing one's awareness, directing it away from the inconsequential and toward the metaphysically essential. Art thereby clarifies a man's grasp of reality. And now let me quote from Miss Rand, who, as usual, gave the whole lecture in two sentences. And she said in the Romantic Manifesto, just as a throwaway, you could take any sentence of hers and give a whole lecture on it. She just says this as a throwaway in the Romantic Manifesto. In this sense, art teaches man how to use his consciousness. It conditions or stylizes man's consciousness by conveying to him a certain way of looking at existence. I mean, if you get it, you don't need any more. And if you don't get it, well, maybe you will. Now let's turn to real life for a minute to see what the use of this would be. Let's say you're living with someone, a romantic partner for a year, 2 years. Now, you know, I'm sure, the danger of falling into a rut where routine and taking out the garbage and so on swallows everything. And then suppose one day you raise the question, or she does, what about marriage? Now, at that point, if you're a decent person, your instinct is to look anew. To look and see, what is this person? What is she to me? Now, hopefully, when you turn on that type of focus, you drop all the inconsequential things. They simply fade away by the fact that they're unimportant. And you orient yourself to focusing on stressing, naming what counts. If you couldn't do this, then you would never be able to decide what to do. Because the good, the bad, and the indifferent would all weigh equally on your mind. Your partner's essential honesty, say, would be counterbalanced by the fact that she leaves the newspaper all over the table when she finishes reading, so there'd be one good and one bad, and how can you decide? Now, in making major decisions, whether marriage or to employ someone or even to hire a long-term babysitter, every decent person tries to take an essentialized view of the entities involved and drop, let's call it, the routine perspective. But this is tantamount to saying, although most people don't know it, let me look at the entities involved as though I were putting them in a novel. What would I use from this person in a novel, and what is irrelevant or meaningless or the accident of illness, etc., that simply doesn't count. Now, this skill, which is critical in life, the technique of being able to take this perspective, is precisely what is trained by great art. Philosophy teaches you what is essential in content. Art gives you the practice of seeing essentials everywhere, and therefore of automatizing your philosophy. And I think this is a perfect analogy to learning a language. Learning the grammar and vocabulary in class is pure theory, and that corresponds to learning abstract philosophy. But speaking the language on a regular basis, and thereby automatizing it, corresponds to art. So it's not a contradiction to say, being steeped in Dostoevsky or Tolstoy's universe heightens your ability to perceive the universe as you stylize it. And therefore heightens your ability to keep objectivism alive in your soul as something other than abstract floating theory. Now I want to go on to an even more telling aspect than characterization, which is the story or events of a novel, so far as that teaches you stylization. And I want to look at each of our novels for a minute or two from that point of view as examples. Now, since everything in these two novels happens to be relevant and essential, the best way would just be to read it to you from cover to cover, but I have to necessarily excerpt. Crime and Punishment tells a story of a man who makes an immoral choice of values, acts on it, excuse me, and gets justice in the end. Now, of course, Dostoevsky's standard of immorality is not the objectivist one, but we can abstract away from that. The book deals with the inevitable consequences of a certain kind of evil action and how it dooms Raskolnikov, how it brings him down. So broadly speaking, Crime and Punishment stresses the power of morality. which, you know, to that extent is a viewpoint congenial to objectivism. But you have to remember that the theme says that morality consists of sacrificing to God. So that takes a big lump out of the our congeniality here. But my point here is that the total stylization of the novel's events, regardless of its theme, Dostoevsky takes a single great immorality and looks at everything from this one point of view. How does this immorality affect or redound on this and that and this and that and every other aspect? The suspense of the story as a story is, can Raskolnikov get away with it? And the events, both existential and psychological, within his own soul, show step by step that everything is closing in on Raskolnikov and that his action has doomed him. And the stress here is on everything. There is nothing in that novel that is not put there to underscore, hammer home, or worsen Raskolnikov's plight. And it's all logically interconnected, so that you can see by the end that in the moment of axing these women, he had just as well have cut his own throat. Every event, every subplot, every minor character. And I want to introduce this term because I think it captures something. The novel, and Dostoevsky himself, you can say, is obsessed. Obsessed with Raskolnikov's crime. Nothing matters to Dostoevsky in this novel except that crime and its consequences. And that is precisely the mark of great art. I think that great art is a form of obsession or monomania. It is the exact opposite of anything moderate, middle of the road, or Republican. By its nature, by its nature, great art is extremist and fanatic. Is that simply another way of saying it's stylized? It focuses only on what is metaphysically important to the artist, and it simply brushes away as worthless everything that doesn't come under this great concern. Now, here's just a couple of passing examples out of dozens from Crime and Punishment. Let's start with the simple fact that Raskolnikov loves his sister. Well, what has this got to do with his crime? Well, another character, now I don't, no one has ever pronounced these names before me, so whether this bears any connection, I don't know. Svidrigaylov wants to sleep with her, and he is basically the novel's Ellsworth Toohey, a monstrous pedophile and killer who laughs at his own vice. You see, to Dostoevsky, he represents egoism, a person who tries to live for his own pleasure. In other words, he is the extreme version of the very evil which, in Dostoevsky's opinion, drove Raskolnikov to commit his crime. Svidrigaylov is, in effect, the devil out to tempt Raskolnikov to persist in his evil course. How? By threatening to expose Raskolnikov's crime if Raskolnikov doesn't sanction his evil designs on Raskolnikov's sister. So, as soon as we start the story, Raskolnikov's love of his sister and fear for her safety become a hook jabbed into his mind and completely enmeshed as one of the consequences of the crime, and he has to deal with this monster who finds out about it by overhearing his confession. Now, of course, at the other extreme is Sonia, this prostitute with the heart of Jesus, submissive, 100% submissive and saintly. What makes her so good? Dostoevsky would say the exact opposite of the self-assertiveness that drove Raskolnikov to crime. And what does she spend her goodness trying to do? To bring Raskolnikov to his knees, to stop trying to escape, to repent and confess. So we have a devil and an angel, or a Jesus figure, and they're both, the motive of both is to ensnare Raskolnikov, given that he committed his crime. And that's just the start. You see, the characters, all their actions are centered on this obsession with crime and punishment. There's also, I mean, hundreds more, but dozens more, but there's the brilliant detective work of Porphyry. He's the chief of detectives. And he has really fascinating cat and mouse interrogations with Raskolnikov. Porphyry has found out that Raskolnikov is guilty, using basically psychological insight and a few clues, and he's trying to force him to confess. And the point is that Porphyry is an intellectual. He is not, you know, just a clue assembler like Perry Mason. He, too, is completely involved in the theme and the crime, and he wants to save Raskolnikov's soul, and he thinks getting him to confess is the best way. And he has studied Raskolnikov's articles, including the ones, you know, that preach Hegel. And they have the most absolutely thrilling conversations in which Porphyry is taking formulations from the articles on Hegel and using them to trip up Raskolnikov. He says, in effect, oh, is that what you believe? They're just having a theoretical discussion. That's what you believe about crime. Boy, if that's what you think, I bet you wouldn't hesitate to commit a crime like this latest axe murder. Raskolnikov is half defiant because he wants to defend the theories and half terrified. And he's inwardly raging and outwardly squirming. And he's constantly saying to himself, I have to be natural. I have to be deliberately natural. How can you be deliberately natural? And the whole Dostoevsky's point, of course, is to stress his theme, namely, Raskolnikov's own ideas are incriminating him to the police. In other words, here again, he's stressing the intellect is his downfall. Now, you don't have to obviously agree with that, but it's, again, everywhere you look, the material of the theme is stressed, focused, highlighted. You get a completely overwhelming universe in which only what counts is there. And of course there's the spy that Raskolnikov sees on the street terrifying him with the chance of being caught, and the guilt because he's torn, he has this better side, torturing him to confess, and he gets to the police station sometimes and his mouth is about to confess because he can't stand the agony anymore, along with the defiance and the nihilism, and all of it is put into one tremendous unity. Now contrast that with, quote, real life. In real life, as you hear on talk radio all the time, people commit crimes, they don't turn a hair, or they repress them, or they compartmentalize them, or anyway, they seem to get away with them. But in this novel, crime and punishment face Raskolnikov and us everywhere. The crime shapes and transforms every event, direct or indirect. And after you come away from it all, if you read it properly, you might say you feel, well, since you know you've been hammered home with the theme all the way through, you might say, well, don't you come out feeling I better stop thinking and sacrifice myself to God? All that I can say is I do not come away with that feeling from Crime and Punishment. I come away, even in my more bitter moments, which I definitely have, but I come away feeling maybe we still do have a chance because there is meaning in what's happening. It's not just a meaningless tale of unintelligible people doing insane things. Maybe the trifles that bother me day to day don't really count, and I should pay more attention to what counts from my point of view, just the way Dostoevsky did to what counts from his point of view. After all, he was caught in a world where the science and industry were taking over, and he didn't, you know, he was able to present the world as he saw it and keep that real on the grounds of that was what was real metaphysically. So I say to myself, try to look at life the way Dostoevsky looked at murder, not concretely, but in that X-ray vision. And I find that after on the momentum from reading great art, I mean, it doesn't wipe out every disaster of life, but it gives me a push back into the right direction. Now I want to give you Anna Karenina as another example of how the events do this. And I'm deliberately doing Anna Karenina because we have no sympathy whatever for anything in this novel. But it's a perfect example of Tolstoy. is a great artist, and you can see his obsession with purposeful perception in this. Now, this Anna Karenina is a deterministic or naturalistic novel. It doesn't have devils and saints like Svidrigaïlov or Sonya. Just mixed people, quote as they are, with varying degrees of strength or weakness. And you have to sympathize with Anna, the heroine, because she's presented as falling hopelessly in love and being unable to change her honest passion, which, given the condemnation of adultery by her society, simply dooms her from day one to disaster. So both of the novels that we're looking at today are really could have been titled Crime and Punishment. But Anna's crime, falling in love, is not volitional. It's not murder. It's the crime, in general terms, of seeking personal happiness by defying society's conventions and leaving her rotten husband, for which crime she is punished by Tolstoy more severely than Raskolnikov. Dostoevsky gave Raskolnikov 8 years in Siberia for killing these two old ladies. Tolstoy has Anna commit suicide for her crime. So philosophically, Anna Karenina is much worse than Crime and Punishment. In fact, Ayn Rand has called it the most evil book in history, most evil artwork. But again, my point here is not theme and not even technique, but rather how purposefully Tolstoy looks at the world. Now, I admit, in this novel, there are some boring stretches where Tolstoy can't resist putting in his political opinions. They're irrelevant, and they should have been cut. But if you read enough of this stuff, you skim right over. As soon as you see there's no characters that interest you, and there's not much dialogue, and there's a lot of abstract discussion of Russian politics, just jump right over until it picks up again, and you won't miss anything. Now, let's just give you an idea by looking at the beginning and the end, basically, how obsessed Tolstoy is, which is the mark of a really great art. The book starts with the epigraph. You know the famous quote at the beginning of the book? And the epigraph is, "Vengeance is mine, saith the Lord." And then the first sentence, which is famous. Listen to this for a first sentence to strike your theme. Happy families are all alike. Every unhappy family is unhappy in its own way. In other words, tells you that happiness is boring and that this novel, by contrast, is going to be about something interesting. So, you know, this is not a guy who fools around. Then the first scene with a minor character. And guess what this minor character has just done? He's just cheated on his wife and thereby hurt her deeply. And that's how we meet Anna for the first time. She's coming to try and reconcile the heartbroken wife to the fact of her husband's adultery. Already at this point, you see the obsession starting to blossom. He's got this adultery on the mind, and you're starting to be drawn into a world where everything is going to be stylized and focused on that. Now, I can't give you the blow-by-blow, but let's jump to Anna's and Vronsky's meeting at the railroad station. They look at each other. It's love at first sight. And almost immediately, on a nearby railroad track, a man falls on the tracks under a train and is killed in a horrible accident, which is burned into Anna's memory, and she says she feels somehow it's an omen. So, I mean, in great novels, people don't fall under trains just accidentally. Jump ahead to the time they first make love, which is in a 19th century Russian novel, it takes quite a while. Is it ecstasy? The way it would be, you know, when Dagny and Reardon do an Atlas Shrugged. A quote from Tolstoy. They've just separated from making love. I mean, come apart physically. Quote, "Vronsky felt what a murderer must feel when he sees the body he has robbed of life." And with fury, as it were with passion, the murderer falls on the body and drags it and hacks at it. So he covered her face and shoulders with kisses. Unquote. Now that's perfect. Completely eloquent, purposeful analogy, hammering home the theme. Every touch in this novel has that same obsession. Well, the purposeful events just continue Anna's struggles with her vindictive husband, a truly heartbreaking parting from her young son, whom she loses through her adultery. And that's a scene I personally cannot read without breaking into tears. Then Vronsky loses his army career because Anna's considered a drag by the army. Then they're snubbed by society, and then the two of them are alone from morning to night with each other. They're both unemployed. Vronsky starts to feel that she's smothering him, and he wants to go off with the boys. And Anna is growing jealous because she senses his resentment, and they fight, and finally it all falls apart. I'm just giving you, you know, sort of a plot blurb here. She starts to feel she's given up everything for Vronsky, her child, her life, everything, and now she's lost everything. She rushes to the railroad station in a frenzy to find Vronsky. She doesn't even know why she's there, to find him or talk to someone or just to get away from this room which is closing in on her. She feels that love is a myth, that it's all phony. She sits down in the train, and here is Tolstoy, obsessed to the end. She's in this absolutely, you know, frantic state. A couple sits down directly across from her. I'm just filled with admiration that you could think of such a thing. Quote, both husband and wife seem repulsive to Anna. They make inane and affected remarks to one another entirely for her benefit. Anna saw clearly that they were sick of each other and hated each other, and no one could have helped hating such miserable monstrosities. And then someone laughs. It was so clear to Anna that there was nothing for anyone to be glad of, that this laughter irritated her agonizingly, and she would have liked to stop up her ears not to hear it. A few pages later, I think I can even give you this if you can take it, but it'll give you some idea of the power that certainly transcends my synopsis. A few seconds later, she's outside staring at the wheels of a train that's coming on. She has a sudden memory of the man who was crushed by the train the day she first met Vronsky, and she knew what she had to do. I'm just going to give you excerpts because I can't read it all, but just try to get a, this is the very, very last page of the novel. A feeling such as she had known when about to take the first plunge in bathing came upon her, and she crossed herself. That familiar gesture brought back into her soul a whole series of memories of her childhood and girlhood, and suddenly the darkness that had covered everything for her was torn apart, and life rose up before her for an instant with all its bright past joys. But she did not take her eyes from the wheels of the car. And exactly at the moment when the midpoint between the wheels drew level with her, she threw away her bag and, drawing her head back into her shoulders, fell on her hands under the car, and with a light movement, as though she would rise immediately, dropped on her knees. And at the instant she was terror-stricken at what was she doing. Where am I? What am I doing? What for? She tried to get up to throw herself back, but something huge and merciless struck her on the head and dragged her down on her back. Lord, forgive me everything, she said, feeling it impossible to struggle. A peasant muttering something was working above the iron, and the light of the candle by which she had read the book filled with troubles, the book of life, filled with troubles, falsehood, sorrow, and evil, flared up more brightly than ever before. Lighted up for her, all that had been shrouded in darkness flickered, began to grow dim, and was quenched forever. Now I say that's a very, very powerful ending. And in case that's not enough, Tolstoy has, to carry his obsession one step further, an epilogue. in which we learn that Vronsky is going off to die in a useless war, and on top of that, right at this moment, has a horrible throbbing toothache. So he's disfigured by pain the last you see him. Now you can see why Ayn Rand said this is the most evil novel ever. It presents a truly vicious philosophy, but it exhibits the stylization of great art, and that is even being completely naturalistic. You have to say that Tolstoy was not a normal guy. He was not the boy next door, but I say that as a compliment. Now, I don't retain the details of his novels or any of these novels for very long, or of the characters or even of the story. What I retain is the sense of looking at life with the eyes of an artist. And what such art, whether true or false in its theme, keeps alive in me as nothing else can, is a non-everyday view of the world, and therefore a really philosophical view of the world. I also want to point out that there is an emotional reward, which is not exactly the emotion that I just hopefully invoked in you. I find, if it's great art, a kind of emotional excitement or inspiration or even fuel. Now, obviously, I do not mean this in the sense that I get emotional fuel from reading Ayn Rand. I don't get a sense of man the heroic or the possibilities of human greatness or the ideal embodied or what might be and ought to be. It's a totally different sense, but nevertheless a sense that is real. There is a certain sheer excitement in experiencing this X-ray stylization. It's the excitement of feeling, I am for now, in a unique dimension where I can experience reality profoundly and in a way I don't normally. It's like seeing the world in color in three dimensions when normally it's black and white and flat. Now, the fuel from reading Atlas Shrugged is pure pleasure and uplift from the fact of living on Earth. But the fuel in Dostoevsky and Tolstoy is more like the pleasure of being in outer space, a special outer space where you prepare yourself for life once you land. Now, this kind of fuel or inspiration is often in direct contradiction to the evil theme of the book. So the authors are giving you this despite their themes. For example, essential to both Dostoevsky and Tolstoy is the logic of the events and portrayals that they offer. And that implies the value, the validity, the reliability of logic, regardless of their continuous sniping attacks at it. Or inherent in deliberate methodical characterizations is the idea that men's purposes do count, that chosen values do matter, regardless of what the artist may preach as his theme. Or inherent in the clarity and orderly structure of these works is the implicit message that the world is intelligible, that our minds can understand it, that we are able to function, we are potent, we can be efficacious. Now, these are messages that come through by the very nature of the art, if it's great art, and purposeful and stylized, despite the themes. So in that sense, you can say great art, or at least the kind I like, even if its theme is wicked, implies a valid philosophy to an extent by the sheer fact of its perfect stylized integration. Now, there's a limit to this implication and to the fuel that it provides, an obvious limit since the theme contradicts the implicit message. Nevertheless, the message is there, and you can be uplifted by it despite the contradiction. Millennia from now, people are going to look back and wonder at how spiritually primitive men still were in the technologically advanced 20th century. In this kind of age, we simply do not have an abundance of thematically pro-life or pro-reason art. But we still need art. You need art, and I need art, and I mean art, not a detective story or a TV dramatization of the disease of the week or a Steven Spielberg special effects flick about dinosaurs on the loose. So I want to conclude by making a pitch for you to consider making use of what we do have. If there was enough Ayn Rand, if she had written 100 books, 150, I'd never give this lecture. I'd say, who needs this? I'd just keep reading another one by her till I died. Unfortunately, she only wrote 4 and a few short stories and plays. There's not enough to last for a lifetime. You might decide to just read her and reread her, then you'll reach the stage where I got at one point and had to stop. I reached the point many decades ago where we used to play a game. Someone could open the fountainhead at random and utter 2 or 3 words, anything more definite than he said. And I could right away finish the sentence, say who said it and where from. And it got to the point where basically I had the entire book memorized. It was just unreadable anymore. And I had to stop. And that's one of the things that made me decide to start exploring after that and after, you know, romantic literature, Hugo and people like that, to try looking elsewhere. And I found that there is plenty of great art before our time, even if not much today, and that you can gain something important from much, not all of it, but much. There's a gold mine awaiting your discovery. And if you ask me, I'm happy to recommend a few books as a start. But first, you have to make the decision that you want to go and dig out the gold that is waiting for you. And my only hope for today is that this lecture gives you reason, at least, to think it over before you just say, it's all wrong, to hell with it. Thank you very much. Okay, I'll take questions. Yes, sir.
You've talked about the role of stylization in art. How would you apply it to a visual art such as architecture? And especially when architects today are forced to deal with such arbitrary concretes as zoning codes, building codes, Americans with disabilities requirements.
Well, you're asking me a question of aesthetic theory in a field of which I know nothing. So it's not on the topic nor in a subject area that I know. I certainly sympathize with architects. I happen to know one architect well, and he gives me horror stories and what he's up against with zoners and planners and the neighboring community that insists on all kinds of stuff. I mean, that's tantamount to trying to get a job in university and teach something that is not nonsense. I have no solution for that. Proper, every art is stylized. But architecture is a unique art in that it also has a practical function. So the key to stylization in architecture, all I know, is the issue of form follows function. The stylization has to be to stress and underscore the structure, and that has to be determined by the function of the building. But I do not think, I just don't know, but I don't think you would learn this technique of perception from architecture unless you are in architecture and you're able to see, to get a revitalized sense of how to look at the world through it. I couldn't do it. The only art that works for me, really, in this is literature and secondarily sculpture, because I get a great deal of this focus on the essential when I see, like, Michelangelo or ancient Greek sculpture that counteracts, because you can read into it, you know, a character. I'm not very good on the visual arts. I'm sure that experts in the visual arts like Marianne Suries would explain to you in detail how it works. And I'm sure I've seen some paintings where it helps me, but I guess I don't see too well, or I've never been exposed too much to the visual arts. So I have to restrict my comments to literature. Okay? Jason.
You said that art helps you, great art helps you see the world in essentialized terms. You must know that there are some people who already do this better than others. My question is, do you think that great art is more important for the people who have not developed this capacity in order to help them develop it more fully?
No, I don't think so. You mean people who don't know philosophy?
People who have a hard time seeing the world in essentialized terms, who don't do that normally.
I mean, great art would be helpful, but I don't know how helpful it would be apart from some philosophic understanding, because the risk that you run if you plunge yourself into art with corrupt themes and are not inoculated is that the artist will make his theme so plausible you'll start to believe in it. Now, Amy pointed out to me several times that there's a danger in reading too many Russian novelists because they are so malevolent and they all believe in sacrifice and redemption through suffering and the superficiality of happiness and so on. I wouldn't have wanted to be exposed to that without a philosophic inoculation that enables me to discount that very early. So I more see the role of great art as revivifying an ability to then apply philosophy that you know. I do think it's valuable to read great art and to analyze it, but ideally, before you know philosophy, but you should ideally go through it with someone who can help you analyze the theme and what you think of it and the characters and what you think of them at the same time. I don't think just uncritically steeping yourself in that universe is going to make you think in essential terms. I mean, there's too many great artists that were hopeless philosophically and that did not think in essential terms. So I couldn't maintain that. It's what I said, it's like a vaccination or a booster shot, okay? Yes?
This is a bit of a specific question, but I was wondering if you could comment on the style of Ernest Hemingway and specifically For Whom the Bell Tolls. I don't know if you've read that.
Well, you're way down beyond what we can do here. I'm supposed to be talking about the general role of art with illustrations from Russian literature. I read some of Hemingway. All I can basically tell you is he was not wordy. He wrote simply, straightforwardly, in short sentences. There was a certain cachet to his style. I never thought anything of his themes or his characters. He was, if you'll forgive me and accept present company, an American. And I've never found much in American literature. So Hemingway would be a good example of not finding much, as the best I can say. Yes?
Would you discuss your selected reading list?
Sure. I just happen to have a few remarks here. Now, this is just a few that I suggest as a start. It's in no sense exhaustive. And the only standard I put in basically was, is it good with a bad theme? Obviously, how much you devote to it depends on your time, your interests, and how much you can put up with to get into it. Most great art does not start off with a bang. Some does, but most does not. Now, for instance, War and Peace, which I also think and recommend to you by Tolstoy, the way I started to read that is I was having difficulty with insomnia at one point. And a doctor suggested reading the phone book until you got sleepy for 30 minutes each night, and then as soon as you started to yawn, go to sleep. And I figured I never could get into War and Peace, so I'd use that instead of the phone book. And for about the first, close to 200 pages, I went to sleep within 30 minutes. So it was perfect from that point of view. But then I got into it after a couple hundred pages, and then I was able to read it to the end. It's much more episodic and less connected than Anna Karenina, but it has even more brilliant passages, and it's a genius of a work in terms of, I mean, I'm very high on Tolstoy, however rotten he is as a thinker, because he has the real ability to dramatize his themes in action, and his themes are so hair-raisingly false that it's tremendously impressive that he can actually create more or less believable scenes from these themes. In War and Peace, the outstanding example is Tolstoy is against the great man theory of history. He's against any man theory of history. History has a mystic destiny. and mobs of people do what they do because of the forces of history. But it has one of the themes that individuals are irrelevant. What's going to happen is going to happen as dictated by the unknowable forces of history. And he has the French under Napoleon fighting the Russians, and the Russian generals, the hierarchy working out these commands and strategies and military ploys, and they have it all planned out, and absolutely everything that they worked out and planned comes to naught and is defeated. It isn't relayed. The failure of communication is just as if the bosses, the head of the military, had nothing to say, and the mob instinct of history led the soldiers in the right dispositions to defeat Napoleon. It's better done than I'm saying, but for a dramatization of the helplessness of the individual, it was really very impressive. So it's a question of how much you can take. Can you abstract away from this and say, what an exhilarating presentation of the mystic power of history? I don't know. I've reached a stage where I can do it because there's nothing else that I can read, and to me it's an essential function. So I'd just tell you with that preface that my favorite literature is Russian and French. That's about the only two countries that I could find a number of people that I like. Certainly Tolstoy. If you want to start besides War and Peace, I would suggest a short story called Master and Man, because he wrote a lot of fascinating and gruesome short stories. Dostoevsky, definitely read The Possessed, which is his denunciation of socialism, because you'll even get some political agreement. And he has a fascinating novelette, Dostoevsky, called Notes from Underground, about a man who is driven crazy because 2 and 2 is 4. And this man can't stand the fact that he can't change that. Dostoevsky sympathizes with the man, but is also driven crazy by it. And so it's a fascinating. I like Turgenev, just to give you one more Russian, Ivan Turgenev. Fathers and Sons, I read that novel with great interest. It's supposed to be about a nihilist son, and the nihilist is really interesting because half the time he is a nihilist, and the other half the time he's presented as what I would call a pure objectivist. Because from the point of view of the author, anybody who questions is a nihilist. So half the time he's questioning religion in perfectly reasonable terms, or saying, what's the purpose of this custom? And half the time he's destroying as an end in itself. And from the author's point of view, this is interchangeable. And it was fascinating to see this guy go from a monster to an objectivist and back as the same character from the author's point of view. There's also a very poignant novelette by Turgenev called Spring Torrents, if you like unhappy love stories brilliantly told. Now, I'm not going to give you a whole list from them all, but from French literature, let me just say Balzac. Definitely, I would start with Père Goriot, and it's part of his whole series called The Human Comedy. He wrote dozens and dozens and dozens of novels, and you can pick it up anywhere, but Père Goriot is a good place to start. And it has a really fascinating character, Vautrin, a master criminal, that is really interesting and has plans to take over the world. And although he's denounced as a master criminal, obviously Balzac is really interested in him. And this guy takes over the novel completely and is fascinating reading. Then I would recommend a minor French writer that I find very easy to read, an excellent stylist, Guy de Maupassant. Do you know him? He's famous for that short story, The Necklace, also a very malevolent story. But he's written a lot of interesting novels. I would suggest you start with Pierre and Jean, about two brothers and what they learn about their mother. Now, while we're on the French, I recommend Dumas Père. Not so much Feast, but Père, the old guy. Although he is a romantic, his themes are not the best. But The Count of Monte Cristo, for instance, which has a theme that you couldn't agree with as an objectivist, I could not put that down. And I read the whole big, thick, two-volume edition, and that was pure enjoyment. The Three Musketeers, and there's a whole bunch of them after that, right, leading all the way to the Man in the Iron Mask, are intermittently fun. For English writers, I'll just give you two. They have bad ideas, but good art. One is Dickens. I think the best place to start there is A Tale of Two Cities. And one is one that I loved in college, although it's extremely bitter, so that'll tell you how I was in college, which is Gulliver's Travels. But you have to read all four parts, not just with the little people. The little people are the giants, and there's a whole section on satire. This is a satire on everything. And there's a section of satire on what I would now call rationalists, these people floating above the earth and theorizing with no connection to life. Don't forget also that plays are a great way to get into literature. They're much easier to read than novels. They're shorter. And I recommend strongly all of the authors in the course I gave on great dramas, but especially for great art, Sophocles, Shakespeare, particularly his tragedies, his comedies, I think are, you could sit through them if you're glued to the seat, but his tragedies are usually great. Corneille, the French author, has written many terrific plays. George Bernard Shaw is highly intellectual, sophisticated, well done, episodic and crazy. Ibsen, very tightly structured. Some of it could have been written by an objectivist and some by the exact opposite. While on plays, I suggest for just pleasure, instead of The Disease of the Week or Steven Spielberg, there's a lot of plays that are just fun to read. They're not necessarily going to revitalize your ability to perceive in essentials, but they're neglected comedies that are easy to get into. Oscar Wilde wrote a whole series of good comedies. By the way, he wrote a lot of fairy tales which can be read by adults. May as well mention The Ballad of Reading Gaol, which he wrote, which is brilliantly done, telling about his life in prison. Noel Coward is pretty much forgotten today, but he wrote all kinds of stories and plays which are witty, funny, enjoyable. It's like having dessert, you know. And you can't have only dessert, but you can gorge every once in a while. James Barry is a playwright, and he wrote a play which I once acted in grade school, which has actually a very good thesis too. It's called The Admirable Crichton, and I recommend that to you if you've never read it. And then Eugène Scribe, the French 19th century, S-C-R-I-B-E, wrote a lot of comedies. Now, poetry is also a possibility in that, you know, it's shorter than novels, and I'm certainly no expert on poetry. But I'll suggest a couple of English poets. Usually no other language survives. Poetry doesn't survive translation. But so I basically only know some English poetry. My top favorite is Tennyson. He's written some tremendously moving stuff, some of it being excellent intellectually and some of it being, you know, like War and Peace or whatever, but beautiful, beautiful stuff. For the you know, the real uplifting poetry, I would read Ulysses by Tennyson. To strive, to seek, to find, and not to yield. It ends that way. He's going to go on and conquer the world. And for beautiful tragedy, I'd read The Lady of Shalott. And also one that I loved in school, which is exactly a horror story. Absolutely magnificently done as a poem called Rizpah, R-I-Z-P-A-H. about a mother contemplating her son's bones. He's been hung up as a killer, and she wants to take possession of his bones. And a social worker comes in to, you know, ease her pain and so on, and she tells the social worker off. I found it extremely moving, extremely dramatic. Obviously, it's not a sense of life that I would recommend, but it really fulfills the example of this lecture of a completely bad theme and sense of life with a brilliant art. I would recommend Browning as a poet. Start with My Last Duchess, an absolute gem. Now, I also want to mention, believe it or not, these are possible to read. I know it sounds impossible, but there are all kinds of epics that are, you know, multi-volume that could last you your whole life. And I'll give you one from the ancients, one from the medievals, and one from the moderns. The Iliad or the Odyssey from Homer. But the whole trick with these is to get a translator that makes it intelligible. If you get a translator that tries to keep the poetry, the rhyme and the meter and so on, then it becomes so artificial and impossible in English, you can't do it. So what you want to find is a translator that just tells a story and give up the other. But I finally found one for Homer, and it's E.V. is his initials. I don't know how you pronounce it. Rieu, R-I-E-U. And he actually writes as though he's telling a story. And it's not, you know, mighty seaweed bestrewn Demeter, you know, and so on, where you can barely know what he's talking about. It's English. And you could try Homer. He's got a lot of great stuff. There's a wonderful medieval ballad, French, called The Song of Roland. And this one is translated by Dorothy Sayers. Do you know her? She was the mystery writer. And she does a really great job of capturing it. And what is so enjoyable about these people is that they absolutely want vengeance against the Saracens, you know, against the unbelievers. And the poem describes at some length the way they delight in tearing out the gore of the unbeliever. They have no modern qualms about, you know, killing the evil. They're unrestrained for vengeance. And since I am too, I live vicariously through that. But it's a fast-moving, active, and I think that's easy. And then if you want a modern one, I would suggest Paradise Lost by Milton, in which, you know, it's supposed to be the dramatization of Christianity, and Satan is the hero, and he says, I'd rather rule in heaven than be a slave to that in hell than be a slave to that dictator in heaven. And Milton is obviously on Satan's side, but he's committed to, you know, come out for God, and it's beautiful poetry and very well done. Now, I want to say a word here in conclusion of this question of the stuff that I can't read, because I do not mean to imply that anything acknowledged as, quote, great is going to necessarily have a positive function. There's a lot of stuff I've tried, and I can get through 20 or 50 or 100 pages and say, that's it, I'll never read this. On principle, I'll never read this. So I don't want to be misunderstood as saying anything called great is good for your soul. I'll give you just some category. Anything non-objective, all 20th century of that type. Anything unclear, anything that prides itself on ambiguity and equivocation and, you know, all that, I won't read that stuff. I want it to be like Dostoevsky and Tolstoy, where there's an obsession and they hit you over the head with it. That's exactly what I get out of it, not this evanescent modern garbage. And it's not only modern. Every once in a while you'll find a work that's praised for anticipating the 20th century. And there, every one is worse than the next. For instance, Tristram Shandy by Stern, which I spent a lot of money on buying, thinking, well, this is a classic, and it was absolutely unreadable. Now, then, beside that, boring or episodic works. Now, Tolstoy is episodic in a way, but not like Chekhov. Chekhov, you know, I check out. And by the same token, minutia-laden works that have no sense of essentials. For instance, Madame Bovary by Flaubert. I got dragged myself through about 150 pages of that, and I didn't care if she was run over by a train or what. It was just every detail. Without the details adding up to anything or having any purpose. It was the opposite of what I would consider great art, even though he's put way up there, Flaubert is so terrific. Phony romantic stuff I can't read, like Charlotte Bronte and Jane Eyre, all those gothics with ghosts clanking around and wails coming from the ceiling. As soon as they start, I just put that out. And then above all, I cannot take books whose essence or essential approach is arch, coy, or sarcastic. It's okay to be bitter and angry like Swift, but if there's a feeling of archness or coyness, it just puts me off totally. And for example, Cervantes' Don Quixote, I cannot read. I can't take that guy seriously because it's supposed to be he's satirizing his own hero and he's laughing at himself. Thackeray, Vanity Fair, I couldn't read because he thinks he's so funny. And I have to say this at the hope of not hurting the feelings of a lot of people here. I can't read Jane Austen. For that reason, I know a lot of objectivist women get a lot out of her, and I'm not criticizing you if you do, but she's just too coy for me. It's too arch. There's a way of coming at things that is not blunt and straight, and I can't take that. So I would say I do reject a lot. I buy a lot of books and read 20, 50, 100 pages and say that's out. And my main tests are, no matter what the theme is, it's got to be clear. It's got to have some progression of events, even if not the structure of a plot. It can't just be, you know, completely episodic. It has to have some conviction of reality, not these phony gothics. And it has to be told in a sincere, straight, head-on fashion, not with tongue-in-cheek. And if I find that quality to the work, then I can happily live in a malevolent universe and feel invigorated by it. All right, now let's try to get through some of these questions with dispatch. Can we say that great art is defined as art whose every element is intensively integrated with the theme of the work? Now, I object to the idea of defining great art. That is a mistake at its inception. You do not define a category and the excellent expression of that category under one concept. You define art, for example, and then you have to provide and prove separately objective standards of judgment of what would be good or bad in that category. And then you conclude that great art is art that fulfills the following standards, but that's not a matter of definition. That's a matter of definition of the concept and then a derivation from all the relevant data of the standards by which to judge it. It's just like if somebody said to me, define great man. I say, that's ridiculous. I can define man, and I can specify and prove standards of greatness, and then I can discuss how they apply to a given person, but I have no definition that I can rattle off. A great man is one who combines rationality, creativity, and orange hair. I mean, it can't be done that way, so it's a misuse of the term definition. Now, what I add to my list of fiction works, a partial list of philosophers we should read as intellectual ammunition. I don't think you should read philosophers. I don't think you have to if you're not in the field. You might want to read a book or take my course on the history of philosophy as a summary to get some idea what you're up against. Philosophers are notoriously hard to read. I mean, even for philosophy majors, if you were going to read philosophers at all, I would read excerpted versions from Plato, maybe from the Republic, Aristotle, take the Nicomachean Ethics, because the rest of it you'll just never follow, and read the chapter titles. You get some idea where he stands from that. Descartes is pretty easy reading, and he wrote the same book over and over, so you can read any one of them. But I would say maybe the Meditations is probably the easiest philosophic classic of importance to read. And Kant, I mean, if you can get anything out of him, read the Prolegomena to Any Future Ethics or Any Future Metaphysics, and it'll give you a condensed version. If you're not in philosophy, it's a very painful way of arming yourself. Now, I got a bunch of literary questions I want to try to do quickly in the few minutes remaining. Do I agree that I'm rewording these just to make it faster, that Tolstoy is the greatest novelist ever apart from Ayn Rand? No, I do not. I would list at least, leaving aside the issue of their theme, both Hugo and Dostoevsky are considered greater novelists than Tolstoy because they have elements that Tolstoy does not have. Above all, plots, logical, connected sequence of events. And Tolstoy, by being a naturalist, does not have plots. He has stories, but it's more episodic, and I think that's a weakness in him strictly as an artist. There are other things too. I mean, Hugo is 100,000 times more uplifting. I mean, it's incomparable. Tolstoy thinks life is misery, and Hugo is a sunlit romanticist. But just taking it on the question that it was asked. In regard to my not thinking much of American literature, what about Sinclair Lewis? Yes, I read almost all of Sinclair Lewis's over 20 novels. And he is definitely was enjoyable to read. He had a sharp wit. I think some of it is dated now, but I don't think it's great art. But short of that, I certainly read him. You could read It Can't Happen Here, which is about a fascist dictator coming to power in America. You could read Arrowsmith, about an idealistic young doctor. That's probably his most positive book. I also, by the way, he's a naturalist. I also read a great deal of John O'Hara that nobody hears anymore. Very malevolent, but even more artistic than Sinclair Lewis. And if you want something that will really cast you down, I would recommend Appointment in Samara, his first novel. And his most positive novel is From the Terrace. Now the questioner goes on, what about Thomas Hardy and Vladimir Nabokov? I cannot stay awake even reading Thomas Hardy on the page, just the words. And Nabokov is modern, non-objective, and in my opinion, disgustingly perverted, as evidenced by Lolita. So, since fiction writers are observers of essentials, does Ayn Rand's epistemology in effect come from her approach as a novelist or her philosophic mind? And I say definitely from her philosophic mind, because artists per se are concerned with essentials, but they don't have to reach these essentials qua artist on any rational ground or any ground related to reality. What we mean by essentials is that it expresses their sense of life. And this has not to do with cognition of objective essentials. Translators of Russian literature, I always, if I can, read the Constance Garnett translation. She is an old translator, but that means she was faithful. She did not want to make Raskolnikov sound like a member of a street gang in LA, which some of the current translators do. She was, you know, faithfully reverential to them. It's a little old-fashioned, but I don't mind that. What about Schiller? Yes, I didn't mention him, but I did because he's a romanticist. But he has written some great plays like Don Carlos. You can look at my course on great plays. And some that I must say I find pretty dull. So I find him uneven. Now, here's one that really threw me. I realize our time is up, but there's just three more. Can you take three more? Quick, hit and runs. What is the connection between great art and induction? None. Because great art is a process of creativity, which is largely from the subconscious via a sense of life, which can be terrible, and reached by no valid or cognitive process at all. And induction is an objective cognitive process where you focus on reality. So you can't confuse art presents essentials with therefore the artist had to think rationally or inductively or objectively, because essential in connection with art means what counts to him. So it means that he's purposeful, but his purpose may be completely at odds with reality. So by the same token, can great art teach a young mind to think inductively? No. And as a matter of fact, it can teach you the opposite, because it deliberately skews the evidence. For instance, Anna Karenina. If you went there, I'm going to induce the truth from that, you'd end up with the horrendousness of adultery. So, and the same ring, can immersion in great art significantly curtail rationalist tendencies? No. Don't use art to correct your epistemology. That is not what it's for. Not your philosophical epistemology. And now, second last question. What about great art in the movies? I don't recognize such a phenomenon. Because the movies are a 20th century art form, and great art basically died in the 19th century. This doesn't mean you can't find an occasional movie that is very artistic. The earlier in the century, the more likely. The later, the less likely. Now, if you've read the Romantic Manifesto, you know that Ayn Rand's favorite in this regard was Siegfried, and you can read what she had to say about it. And I could rattle off for you a number of movies, which I think is what this questioner wants, that I enjoyed or that I liked, but I would never put them in the category of great art. But just for what it's worth, I suggest you watch AMC or TCM, you know, the Turner or the American Movie Classic, and watch the movies from the 30s and the 40s. They started to deteriorate in the 50s. Actually, they started to deteriorate when color came in. And in those days, believe it or not, discerning people ran like the plague from any movie made in color, because it meant that the budget went to the photography and not to the script. And consequently, the color movies were all bad. Now they're all made in color, and therefore you can draw your own conclusions. But some of the early Hitchcock were very artistic and stylized, like 39 Steps, for instance. Some of the Ernst Lubitsch comedies, Ninotchka with Greta Garbo was a fabulous comedy. Terence Rattigan, the playwright, some of his works have been made into excellent movies. The Browning version with Michael Redgrave, and The Winslow Boy, where the father takes on a crusade against the total of the British establishment to rescue his son from injustice. Of course, there's The Fountainhead and the Italian We the Living. And then there's all kinds of individual movies that I think you would enjoy if you like movies that are not McLuhan-esque. But, you know, it's a generational thing. If you get brought up with the idea that unless the screen rattles and fizzes and everything moves and Harrison Ford is streaming from the back of a plane holding on to, you know, a rope and three people are trying to kill him and his leg is falling off in one plane. I mean, if that's your idea of movies, then you'll find all this stuff tame, boring, slow, and talky. And today, Hollywood producers, and I know this from them telling me that, regard anything other than the occasional obscenity as a talkie script. They just want to go back and forth, and then every once in a while they use the F word or some other word, and that's the, you know, sum up the meaning of it, and then they go on to some more of it. So any movies I recommend will strike you, if you're under 30, as probably slow, and these people just sit around and talk. It's not true, but that's what they strike people as. But given that, I would recommend, for instance, Laura was a great murder mystery with Gene Tierney. Fabulous movie, I think. All About Eve with Betty Davis before she turned sour. There was all kinds of good movies. I don't call them great works of art, but I certainly would take any one of them over 100 summer box office smashes, such as the one that I walked out of last night. Now, the last question. What is the status of the Atlas Shrugged movie? I have good news and bad news, which follows directly from what I just said. A truly excellent script has been written by Cynthia Peacock. I regard it as impossible achievement. She took that novel and she was told she could make it between 4.5 and 5 hour script, and she made a 5 hour script which actually reproduces this novel in cinematic terms, drops an incredible amount, but keeps the main line, the plot, the essence of the characters. Is unbelievable. I would have sworn that it could not be done. It is now being shopped around, sent around Hollywood, and continuously rejected by everybody who are horrified that there's dialogue in the movie, let alone what the dialogue says, you know. Right now, it scared everybody off totally. The script does exist, though, and that in itself is one big step forward. All we'd have to find is someone who wants to put up $50 million or whatever it is to get it produced. Thank you very much.